On today's show, we are going to continue looking at Gaza after the ceasefire that is currently, as I speak, it is in effect. The war has moved from Gaza to the West Bank. Israel is being very aggressive in the West Bank, but Gazans are being allowed to return to where their homes used to be, which is now mostly a pile of rubble, with a very few exceptions. So we will hear an interview with Norman Finkelstein, a professor, a leading expert in all things Palestinian. He is a U.S. Intellectual, and he is being interviewed on Al Arabiya, an Arabic language station, network, but this interview is going to be in English, obviously. And following that, we will hear from Medea Benjamin, a well-known activist, a Code Pink anti-war activist, and also Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, who has been very outspoken in support of the Palestinians during this genocide, a very courageous Senator Chris Van Hollen. So, first, our interview with Norman Finkelstein on Al Arabiya.
Well, for more analysis on the latest developments relating to Israel and the Palestinian territories, we can speak now to the renowned Middle East researcher and political scientist, Professor Norman Finkelstein, who joins us from New York. Professor Finkelstein, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Al Arabiya News. I wanted to start by asking you about one of the week's top stories. We heard that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is going to be the first foreign leader to meet President Donald Trump since he began his second presidency. What sort of a message do you think that sends to the Palestinians? And what do you think the new administration has in store for the Palestinians and their aspirations for statehood?
The message, I think, is threefold. First of all, it's to appease Donald Trump's base, a large part of which is, here I'm referring to the Republican Party, a large part of which is enthusiastic about Israel. Number two, it's to placate or appease the billionaire Jewish supremacists like Bill Ackman, the billionaire Bill Ackman, who supported Donald Trump. He left the Democrat, he defected from the Democratic Party, and he supported Donald Trump because of his expectation that Trump would give the Israelis a free hand. And number three, in general, he wants to transmit the message that international law will have no part in his administration, that even though a search warrant has been issued by the International Criminal Court against Prime Minister Netanyahu, as well as the former Defense Minister Gallant, that those kinds of considerations, i.e. the rule of law, will be ignored or flouted by the Trump administration. As to the prospects, my guess is that Donald Trump will give the Israelis a free hand so long as it doesn't become an international crisis in Gaza. So if quietly the Israelis can block any humanitarian aid from entering Gaza, if quietly the Israelis can prevent the rebuilding, the reconstruction of Gaza, if quietly the Israelis can force a fait accompli on the Palestinians in Gaza, namely stay and starve or leave, then President Trump will happily go along with it, but he's sufficiently knowledgeable to know that if it becomes a public international issue, that it could become a quagmire for his administration, as it did for the Biden administration.
Okay, so this idea of resettling people from Gaza in Egypt and Jordan, which we heard about from President Trump during the weekend, it's been flatly rejected by both countries concerned. It's also been flatly rejected by the Arab League. But what you're saying is perhaps we haven't necessarily heard the last of it.
I do not believe we have heard the last of it for the following reason. Gaza is no more, as a physical fact. The estimates by the UN are that 92% of the residences, the homes in Gaza, have been destroyed or severely damaged. About two-thirds of the infrastructure has been destroyed. There are about 50 million tons of rubble in Gaza, intermixed with unexploded ordnance and toxic chemicals, toxic substances. So the estimates are it will require probably about 15 years, maybe more, if 100 trucks are admitted a day, which is almost impossible to imagine Israel allowing. It would take about 15 years just to empty out the rubble. Now, Israel will use the excuse that if it allows cement to enter Gaza, which is obviously a sine qua non of reconstructing Gaza, Israel will use the pretext that it can't admit cement because Hamas will reconstruct its tunnels. So the people of Gaza are going to be confronted with a very stark reality, namely, there is nothing to return to, and Israel will have achieved its primary goal, its primary aim the past 15 months has been to, quote, make Gaza unlivable. Let me repeat that. Their primary goal was to make Gaza unlivable. And as things now stand, it is literally unlivable. And so the people of Gaza will be confronted with a very stark choice, which is either to stay and die or to leave. And at that point, by hook or by crook, I believe large numbers of Palestinians, Gazans, will figure out a way, no doubt facilitated by Israel, will figure out a way to leave.
You're making it sound as though a Palestinian statehood has almost never looked more distant a prospect than it does now, not least with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in power. How do you think history is going to look back on a figure like Prime Minister Netanyahu?
I frankly am not particularly interested in how history, with a capital H, looks back on any figure, because the question is always, who is writing that history? If it's history as written by the victims, he's obviously a genocidal, Jewish supremacist, obnoxious, narcissistic, genocidal murderer. And that would be the proper verdict, were it the people, the victims, who write the history. But if it's written by the faithful, loyal scribes of power, institutions like the BBC, institutions like the New York Times, if it's written by those folks, then the record will be that, yes, he did some wrong things, but he was, of course, loyal and faithful to his people.
We were just talking before we crossed to you about the ceasefire that's been in place now in Gaza and has kept the peace for the last week and a half or so. I'm just wondering, President Donald Trump has taken considerable credit for that ceasefire deal being struck. How much credit do you give him for it?
I think that Donald Trump was faced with a dilemma. He announced that a month before he assumed his office that unless the hostages were freed, there would be hell to pay in Gaza. And the problem was for Donald Trump, the hell was already paid in Gaza by President Joe Biden. There wasn't much more he can do in the way of unleashing hell. Secondly, he didn't want to begin his presidency on a monstrous note, which would be unleashing even more weaponry on a defenseless refugee child population. On the other hand, he didn't want to come across as a blowhard on his first day in office. Namely, he said there would be all hell to pay. He had to do something. And so given the two choices of appearing like a monster on his first day in office in a very unpopular, it wasn't a war, it was a genocide, in a very unpopular military action by Israel, and coming across as a blowhard, namely saying there would be all hell to pay and then doing nothing, between those two choices, he opted for telling Netanyahu, you have to sign an agreement that releases the hostages so he can claim that he followed through on his threat, and that the rest, the stage two and stage three, would be consigned to the dustbin.
Just looking at who's in the new Trump administration, the ambassador to Israel, Huckabee, Elon Musk, looking at the inner sanctum, people surrounding Donald Trump, how well advised do you think he is on this particular issue? And what do you think it means for peace prospects, for the future of the Palestinian people, that President Trump is there with those people around him?
I do not believe there's much question, or there ought to be much focus on who's surrounding him. You can be surrounded by rednecks and bizarre figures, or you can be surrounded by very quote-unquote enlightened people like Tony Blinken. It doesn't really make much difference. The common denominator of all these people is very simple, that force works, that we have a near monopoly on force, and that if you consistently, persistently persevere in the resort to force, violent force, that you can get your way. So I don't think there's much utility in investigating the personalities of these people. When it comes to Israel-Palestine, literally only a flea's hop separates a Mike Huckabee from a Tony Blinken. Only a flea's hop.
So you don't think a figure like Elon Musk, who is shaping up to be a really important figure, he's already demonstrated he's a very important figure in the Trump administration. He wields enormous power on social media. He's also extremely close to President Trump. Do you think he might bring something, perhaps a new approach, a new way of looking at this historic problem?
No, I think there's too much of a fixation on flamboyant personalities and not sufficient recognition of the institutional investments in U.S. foreign policy, as well as the normal modus operandi of U.S. foreign policy, which is the exertion of maximal force. Elon Musk probably can't find Israel on the map, and probably couldn't care less that he can't. And people like Mr. Huckabee and others, they have no special personal investment. And even if they did have a personal investment, such as the one by the billionaire Jewish supremacist Bill Ackman, he has a personal investment because his wife is a former Israeli pilot. So I imagine there is a lot of table talk at their estate about how to influence Trump. But the personalities surrounding Trump have no personal investment in Israel. And so it will be the default setting for all of them, which is maximal force to pulverize weak people.
And do you get the impression overall that the US public is particularly interested or particularly concerned about developments thousands of kilometers away in Gaza and in the Palestinian territories? And do you think they're well enough informed?
The US public, I wouldn't say it is any more fickle than other publics. I would say the US public is as prone to news headlines as any other public. And there was a certain point, in particular in the spring of last year, roughly a year ago now, when the student encampments seized the, if it's not imagination, it seized the attention of the U.S. public. And at that point, public concern was pretty steady, even though for a short period of time, and it had an impact on the Biden administration. However, the Jewish billionaire supremacist class, people like Bill Ackman, Barry Sternlicht at Brown University, Robert Kraft at Columbia University, they start to exert their financial leverage on the universities. They ousted, unprecedented in American history, they ousted three Ivy League college presidents, President Gay at Harvard, President McGill at University of Pennsylvania, and the president of Columbia University was eventually ousted. And then the marching orders by the billionaire Jewish supremacist class was to crush all resistance on the college campuses to the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Now, it's gone a step further with Harvard University last week imposing draconian limitations of free speech at Harvard when it comes to Israel and Palestine. So to get back to your question, in my opinion, the main order of the day has to begin on the college campuses under the slogan of Free Gaza, Free Speech, namely the right to free speech and the right to freedom of assembly was crushed last spring around graduation time in May. And the challenge now has to be for every college campus in our country to seize on the slogan, Free Gaza, Free Speech, the right to speak your mind out on the genocide, the ongoing genocide in Gaza, and the right of assembly. So in my opinion, they should set a date, maybe April 1st, 2025, where every college campus in our country simultaneously in synchrony sets up a new encampment. Now that would mean, in my opinion, a direct confrontation, not just with the university administrations, but with an emboldened president, Donald Trump. It would be a direct confrontation. But I think in terms of preserving what remains, the remnants of our democracy in this country, that's a confrontation that should be welcomed by the students, activists, who will play a vanguard role in trying to win back that right to free speech, which was crushed not by the Trump administration, but by the Biden administration, but which Trump will no doubt capitalize on should there be resistance on the college campuses.
Yeah, and I just want to ask you, because I mean, some of our viewers might not be aware of the draconian measures that you're referring to on campuses. And I think you mentioned recently that words like Gaza and genocide are two words that are, in fact, forbidden in some university campuses. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I'm just wondering yourself, as a professor, as an academic, what goes through your mind when you hear that centres of academic excellence are forbidding the discussion of important issues, essentially?
Well, what goes through my mind is how how utterly spineless these university administrations are, how totally lacking in any principle whatsoever these administrations are, and how superficial, how cheap is their commitment to principles like academic freedom. You hear the term over and over again, proudly burnished by these universities. Academic freedom, the university being the ultimate marketplace or free marketplace of ideas, that no thoughts should be banned, that there should be no limits at the university setting on free speech, and how, on the one hand, and how, on the other hand, was so pitiful, so pathetic, how all these universities caved in to big money, to big donors, how easily, without even a whimper, how easily they sold all their so-called, their ballyhooed principles of academic freedom and free speech. It's so pitiful, so pathetic, how these university administrations, beginning with Harvard, acquitted themselves. Remember, we're America. There's no threat of a military coup, of being jailed, of being disappeared, of being tortured in a in a chamber. We don't face those threats, which are faced by so many other peoples around the world. What threats do these universities face? They have, in the places like Harvard, they have tens and tens and tens of billion dollars in endowments. So they may lose from those tens of billions of dollars. They may lose, yes, it's true, a few hundred million dollars in alumni donations. And because of that, you completely capitulate. You sell all your principles. It's so pitiful. The heroic poses they make. But then, at the moment of truth, all their principles collapse like a house of cards.
And as you mentioned just before I asked you that question, a lot of what you were talking about happened on the watch of the previous administration. It happened on President Biden's
watch. That's correct.
And I'm just wondering...
Yes, that should never be forgotten.
Right. And I just want to ask you whether you think ultimately his handling, not just of that issue, but issues right across the Middle East, in particular this issue of what's been happening in Gaza, do you think that's what cost them the election last year?
Obviously, there's been a lot of speculation on that question. And since it involves subtleties of analysis, of which I'm not capable because I've not studied the literature on the subject, I don't wish to comment. What I would want to say is, number one, however awful Trump turns out to be, we must remember that it was the Biden administration that gave the green light to the genocide in Gaza. Some people bewail the fact that Donald Trump says all the people in Gaza should be cleaned out and resettled elsewhere. Have we forgotten already that it was Secretary of State Blinken who went to Egypt and sent his emissaries to Egypt right at the beginning of the Gaza genocide, calling on Egypt to allow the Palestinians, the people in Gaza, to be expelled to the Sinai? There is so far nothing new under the sun. It was all the basic principles were established under the Biden administration.
Professor Finkelstein, you've got a new book coming out later on this year entitled Gaza's Gravediggers, an Inquiry into Corruption in High Places. Now, without giving too much away about the book, you do take aim at the International Court of Justice, in particular one individual, Julia Sebutinde, who is the president of the International Court of Justice. You single her out for some pretty serious misconduct, bribery, blackmail, plagiarism. And you say the ICJ failed Gaza. Why do you say those things?
I would not say as a blanket statement the ICJ has failed Gaza, the International Court of Justice. What I would say is the following. There has been an enormous amount of corruption in the international legal system, including the International Criminal Court, which needs to be distinguished from the International Court of Justice, including the International Criminal Court, where, and I want to emphasize what I'm about to say, it is not my opinion, it is not my feeling, it is the documentary record that shows, and here is what it shows based on my reading of it, my close reading of it. Number one, the chief prosecutor of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, the chief prosecutor preceding the current prosecutor, Karim Khan, her name was Fatou Bensouda from the Gambia. She was almost certainly being bribed or blackmailed by Israel. Almost certainly, the documentary record on her handling of what was the Mavi Marmara case, that was the flotilla, that was the humanitarian flotilla that was attacked by Israel on May 31st, 2010. That case went before the ICC, and Fatou Bensouda desperately and brazenly sought to crush that case in the ICC. She was almost certainly being bribed or blackmailed by Israel. The presiding judge in what's called the pretrial chamber one, it's a very high position, the presiding judge, Peter Kovacs from Hungary, was almost certainly being bribed or blackmailed by Israel. Now, turning to the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, it's almost certainly the case, based on having perused the documentary record, that the current president, she was just elevated to her office because the previous president now holds high office in Lebanon, that Julia Sebutindi, and I'm saying this with complete presence of mind and attending to all of the implications of what I'm saying, based on my examination of the documentary record, she is almost certainly being bribed or blackmailed by Israel, exactly what happened. She is from the Uganda, almost a repeat performance of Fatou Bensouda at the International Criminal Court. And now it's Fatou Bensouda was the chief prosecutor in the ICC, and now Julia Sebutindi is the president of the ICJ. And she is almost certainly being bribed and blackmailed by Israel. The fact of the matter is, the presidency of the ICJ is now, or the president, is in thrall to a foreign power. And that's a very serious issue. However, I would also want to say that the previous president of the ICJ, Joan Donahue, who was from the United States, Joan Donahue after the ICJ found that Israel was plausibly committing genocide in Gaza, after that finding by the ICJ in January, I think it's January 26th, if my memory is right, January 26th, 2024, Joan Donoghue, the former president, went on the British BBC program Hard Talk, and she flagrantly and brazenly lied, L-I-E-D, she lied about what the ICJ found, and she stated that the ICJ did not find that Israel was plausibly committing genocide. That statement by her was a flat out lie. So there is a huge amount of corruption at play in the ICC and the ICJ. However, it also has to be stated that the ICJ, notwithstanding what Joan Donoghue stated or lied about, it did, in my opinion, carry out its task, the challenge before it, beginning in January 2024, then again in February 2024,
okay.
Then again in March 2024, and then right. Again in May 2024, each time South Africa kept coming before the ICJ, and in my opinion, the ICJ did what it maximally could have done.
All right.
To stop the genocide. However, the enforcement mechanisms of the international community, in particular the Security Council, failed South Africa, and of course failed.
All right, Professor, we're going to have to cut you short because we're running out of time, and I want to move on to some other topics, notably the fact that Monday marked the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, where I believe your father was held, and he, of course, survived that ordeal. I want to ask you, as the son of two Holocaust survivors, both of whom passed away almost exactly 30 years ago, at a time when peace and the two-state solution looked perhaps closer than it's looked at any other time in modern history, what do you think they would make of the situation we're in today with regards to what's happening in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories?
I don't have any doubt about where my parents would stand. I would not want to whitewash who my parents were and the fact that, like all of us, myself included, is filled with flaws, inconsistencies, hypocrisies. That's part of being human. However, on the question of human suffering, and in particular on the question of war and its horrors, my parents were, I believe I can say, without any fear of being disingenuous, I believe I could say my parents were utterly, totally principled. Their hearts and their minds would reach out to the people of Gaza, and they would be unsparing in their condemnation of the monsters, the human monsters that currently occupy high office in Israel and their benefactors in the United States. And I am quite sure they would be emphatic in separating themselves, distancing themselves from the Israeli population. I'm not here talking about the Israeli state. The Israeli population, which has displayed, put on display the most horrible manifestations of human degradation and human corruption.
Okay, and just lastly, Professor, I want to ask you, at one stage there was a 10-year ban on you visiting Israel. You've actually been deported from that country, I believe, in the past. Have you tried visiting Israel again? Would you go there again? And what do you make of attempts, are there attempts by Israel to cast you as being some sort of a pariah?
I've made no attempts because it's quite obvious what will happen. And I don't see it as being economical, both in terms of time and cost, to go all the way, to journey all the way over there, only to be told that I'm not going to be allowed in. On the question of pariah, I do not, were it the case that I was a pariah, were it the case, I do not believe that being a pariah is in all circumstances a dishonorable position to occupy. If I might give just one example that comes to mind, there was the great German-born actress Marlene Dietrich. And Marlene Dietrich, during World War II, she sided with the Allies, the British, French, Russians, and Americans, the four main allies. She sided with the Allies against Germany. She was German-born. After the war, when she returned to Germany on occasion to perform, for example, she was jeered and attacked. She had become a permanent pariah in Germany for having committed treason and betrayed her people and her homeland. But in my opinion, in the hearts of all free people, free men and free women, she, like other Germans who quote unquote betrayed their country and betrayed their people, people like the Mann, Thomas Mann and Heinrich Mann, the Mann brothers, they will always be honored in the hearts of free men and free women, even as in their places of birth, they are pariahs.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave there because we're out of time, but we really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. Professor Norman Finkelstein, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
And that was Norman Finkelstein on Al Arabiya Network. Coming up next, we have Medea Benjamin and Senator Chris Van Hollen.
We were at the confirmation hearing today for Lee Stefanik, who is Trump's pick to be the next UN ambassador. And instead of the questions and her answers being all about how are we going to cooperate with the United Nations and the world community to make sure that people are lifted out of poverty, to make sure we are addressing the climate crisis, to make sure we're ready for the next pandemic, it was just the opposite. It was, how are we going to make sure that we get rid of the anti-Semitic rot at the United Nations, and how are we going to counter China's influence and the malign influence of countries like Iran? And the worst was when Senator Van Hollen asked Elise Stefanik if the Palestinians had the right to self-determination. Listen to her answer.
Representative Stefanik, it was a very simple question. I'm just asking you if you agree with the statement that in order to achieve long-term peace and stability in the Middle East, that we have to secure the human rights and rights of self-determination for both Israelis and Palestinians. That's a yes or no.
I support human rights for all, and I think it's a disgrace that Hamas and Hezbollah have stripped human rights of the Palestinian people, and we need to ensure that we are standing up for human rights, and Israel is standing up for human rights. It is a beacon of human rights in the region.
We agree with that. I asked you in my office also about whether Palestinians have the right of self-determination. My understanding was you said yes. Do you have a different answer today?
That was not the direct question that we discussed. I said the Palestinian people...
You believe the Palestinians have the right of self-determination?
I believe the Palestinian people deserve so much better than the failures that they've had from terrorist leadership.
It's just a pretty simple question.
And I believe we need peace in the region. Of course they deserve human rights.
So
I want to ensure that, number one, we bring the hostages home.
So do all of us. Representative Stefanik, let me just ask you. I have 30 seconds left. I'm rarely surprised by answers in my office, but I did ask you whether you subscribe to the views of Finance Minister Smotrich. Smotrich, this is the Israeli Finance Minister Smotrich, and the former National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, who believe that Israel has a biblical right to the entire West Bank. And in that conversation, you told me that, yes, you shared that view. Is that your view today?
Yes.
Okay. I think when it comes to this very difficult issue, if the president is going to succeed at bringing peace and stability to the Middle East, we're going to have to look at the UN Security Council resolutions, not just the ones on Lebanon, which we should enforce, but other UN Security Council resolutions. And it's going to be very difficult to achieve that if you continue to hold the view that you just expressed, which is a view that was not held by the founders of the State of Israel, who were secular Zionists, not religious Zionists. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.